From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As the Bush administration targets nearly 60 million acres of national forests, well-funded anti-environmental groups and companies are targeting the nonprofit status of the Rainforest Action Network, a group that engages in civil disobedience, boycotts, and direct action in its fight against logging. And investigative journalist Seymour Hersh on what Mobil did to acquire a stake in one of the world's richest oil fields. We'll take a look at the price of oil, what the oil giant was up to in Kazakhstan and Russia. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Environmental attorney Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and New York labor leader Dennis Rivera were among several people sentenced to 30 days in prison on Friday for trespassing on Navy land during April protests against the Navy's bombing of Vieques. The judge warned early on he was not going to allow political or philosophical views to affect the trial, but in one clearly political moment, the judge sentenced Puerto Rican Senator Norma Burgos to 40 days and explained her longer sentence by saying, "You're a lawmaker, not a lawbreaker." Senator Burgos replied by requesting to address the court, and when the judge assented, began assailing it for what she felt was its blind support of the Navy's policies. The judge then changed her sentence to 60 days. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, who attended the trial, pointed out that trespassing is a Class B misdemeanor, which is less than a traffic ticket. Mario Cuomo, the former governor of New York, defended Kennedy and Rivera. In his pre-sentencing statement, Cuomo invoked the celebration of independence and asked the court to, quote, recall that our nation was conceived in the civil disobedience that preceded the Revolutionary War, and that the acts of civil disobedience involved in the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793, the famous sit-down strikes of 1936 and 1937, the valiant struggle for civil rights in the 60s, and the movement against the Vietnam War were always treated by the courts not like crimes committed for personal gain or out of pure malice, but as technical violations designed to achieve a good purpose. The former governor of New York went on to say the degree of judicial punishment has always reflected that difference. Eugene Scalia, a Washington lawyer who has specialized in representing management in labor disputes, may face serious obstacles in his effort to be confirmed as solicitor of the Labor Department. Scalia, the son of Justice Antonin Scalia, is coming under sharp scrutiny by the AFL-CIO, as well as Senator Edward M. Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts, who recently assumed the chairmanship of the Senate Labor Committee. Kennedy and officials of the Labor Federation have said they're deeply concerned about Scalia's published writings concerning the reach of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, particularly on ergonomics. He's written that ergonomic studies used to draft the rules were akin to junk science and would serve only to increase business costs. More developments in the case of Chandra Levy, the former intern with the Department of Prisons, who's been missing since April 30th. A spokesperson for her family said yesterday that Levy's parents found little solace in California Congressman Gary Condit's admission that he's had an affair with their missing daughter and will ask him to take a polygraph test because they doubt he's disclosed all he knows. Their statement comes after police questioned Condit for a third time on Friday night. According to Washington Post, sources say Condit acknowledged in an interview for the first time he had an affair with Chandra Levy. The admission reversed the position his aides had adamantly maintained since the case of the missing intern broke in early May. Levy's parents say Condit has hindered the investigation by taking weeks to disclose the affair. A congressional study has found that the votes of poor people and members of minorities were more than three times as likely to go uncounted in the 2000 presidential election than the votes of more affluent people. The study, conducted for Democratic members of the House Government Reform Committee, focused on 40 congressional districts in 20 states. It found the type of voting equipment used was crucial, with voters using punch card machines seven times as likely to have their ballots discarded as those using machines that employ a special writing instrument and warn a voter if the ballot is about to be spoiled. This news from Oklahoma. For 18 years, the McAllister Regional Health Center has sold sodium thiopental, pancuronium, bromide and potassium chloride for use in executions at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary's death chamber, but no more, says Stephen Cushing, a spokesperson for the hospital 100 miles south of Tulsa. He said this just didn't seem consistent with our mission. He went on to say we're involved in caring for people, not killing them. Cushing said the current directors of the hospital became aware of the sales only after inquiries by a group opposed to the death penalty, Human Rights Watch. The Financial Times is reporting that the U.S. Federal Trade Commission is to step up its investigation of allegations that large drug companies illegally block low-priced generic drugs from getting to the market. The expanding investigation, which has already led to charges against Schering Plow, Abbott Labs, and Aventis, could lead to a new wave of lawsuits against the world's largest drug companies. So far, the sweeping FTC inquiry into the industry, launched during the Clinton administration, has focused on collusion between brand names and generic manufacturers, leading to charges that several large companies paid smaller rivals to keep their low-cost alternatives off the market. But in an interview, the new FTC chair, Timothy Muris, said the FTC investigation would expand beyond collusion cases and into attempts by brand-name companies to block unilaterally the rollout of generics. This news from Colorado. The Department of Motor Vehicles will soon install security cameras on Colorado roads that digitally record facial data. Old driver's license photos will be scanned into a computer database, and new photographs of drivers on the road will be compared with those on file. Proponents say the system will help prevent driver's license fraud. Opponents fear invasion of privacy. And the northern English city of Bradford was quiet early today after an Indian restaurant, an Asian-owned petrol station, and a bar were attacked in a second night of racial violence. The overnight violence was on a smaller scale than the race riots, which rocked the city on Saturday night, injuring 120 police and some of the worst street violence seen in Britain for years. 36 people were arrested. The violence started when rumors spread that the white supremacist National Front planned to defy a government order and march through town. Anticipating the march, the anti-Nazi League held a counter-demonstration on Saturday in Centenary Square in the center of town. About 500 people, mostly Asian men, took part. Officials said a group of whites then emerged from a nearby pub and began to shout racial abuse at the demonstrators, who responded with violence that grew.
And a bill will be proposed, section number one. We're shutting down the oil rigs and turning towards the sun. The air will be clean for all the boys and girls, 'cause we don't want your oil tankers, we just want the world. Face the executioner, shut the logging camps all down. Get busy planting hemp, leave the trees there in the ground. Life is too precious on this little spinning pearl, 'cause we don't want your bulldozers, we just want the world. We'll be closing down the jails and fixing up the schools, distributing those stocks and bonds, changing all the rules. We'll elect a CEO, maybe a rabbit or a squirrel, 'cause we don't want your money, we just want the world.
David Rovick singing We Just Want the World here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Nearly 60 million acres of national forest are now in the crosshairs of the Bush administration, and one of the groups that fights to preserve them is being targeted by a trio of anti-environmental groups and companies. This weekend, the Bush administration began looking to roll back the new forest regulations passed in the waning days of the Clinton administration. The regulations are called the Roadless Initiative and would help to preserve the national forest from logging and road construction. Timber giant Boise Cascade, the paper industry, and conservative policy rights groups are leading the charge against it. Last month, the Frontiers of Freedom Institute, a conservative think tank and advocacy group backed by oil and tobacco money, filed a complaint with the Internal Revenue Service against the Rainforest Action Network, calling for the group's tax-exempt status to be revoked. The Institute charges that RAN, the Rainforest Action Network, has violated its status as a 501c3 educational organization by engaging in pressure campaigns, boycotts, and direct action against corporations and politicians, including many of those that oppose the Roadless Initiative. The group Frontiers of Freedom Institute was founded in 1995 by former Senator Malcolm Wallop, a Wyoming Republican and one of the most conservative members of the Senate, a friend also of Vice President Dick Cheney. Its biggest contributors include Philip Morris, ExxonMobil, and R.J. Reynolds Tobacco. Frontiers says that RAN, the Rainforest Action Network, is, quote, fundamentally radical, anti-capitalist, and lawless, and spotlights the organization recently in a meeting on Capitol Hill on what it called eco-terrorism. RAN executes highly visible, aggressive campaigns primarily against logging corporations, cutting down old-growth forests in North America and around the world. Its tactics have included consumer boycotts and symbolic, media-savvy direct actions. RAN helped the Rucka Society and other groups in planning the protests at the November 1999 WTO meeting in Seattle. Most recently, RAN has targeted logging giant Boise, Mitsubishi, and Occidental Petroleum, among other multinational corporations. RAN says the Frontiers of Freedom Institute is using the tax codes to attack its First Amendment rights and, by extension, those of other groups whose politics it disagrees with. Some other groups are expressing anxiety about the IRS case. They fear a chilling effect on anti-corporate protests if the Institute's challenge is successful. We're joined right now by three people to discuss and debate this issue. We'll begin with George Landreth. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Why is the Frontiers of Freedom Institute challenging the tax status of the Rainforest Action Network?
Actually, what we've asked the IRS to do is examine it. But nonetheless, the reason we are is because when one accepts a 501c3 status, that makes them a charitable educational foundation, and they're required by law to operate exclusively for educational purposes. And what we see is that they're operating outside of that parameter. And so what they're doing, they can do whatever they want to do. We don't really view this as a First Amendment issue because they can do what they want to do. Other groups do as well. They just don't try to get the tax-exempt status. What they try to do instead is operate as a different sort of entity. And that's what this issue really is about, is whether or not they're going to abide by the tax code or not. Quite frankly, whether they continue to do what they're doing, that's their business. They can do that, but using tax-exempt funds to do it violates the law, and it strikes us that if we have to abide by the law, if the Sierra Club has to abide by the law, that they should have to abide by the law as well.
George Landreth, Executive Director of the Frontiers of Freedom Institute. Chris Hatch, you're Executive Director of the Rainforest Action Network. Well, what about that?
Well, I see this as a classic case of shoot the messenger, really. I don't think anyone believes for a moment that the Frontiers of Freedom Institute has suddenly found a high-minded interest in nonprofit tax law. This is a result of many years of highly successful campaigns, which have really turned the corner lately on the timber industry, when Home Depot and other large corporations have come out recently saying they're not going to buy old-growth wood anymore and actually supporting a moratorium on logging in the national forest, at least the intact areas of them. We've seen a real sea change in the timber industry, and this is the timber and oil industry's response, is to come after us as an organization because they're losing on the issues.
Well, what about this issue, what you can do as a 501c3, Chris Hatch?
Well, I mean, to take a classic American example, Martin Luther King's church and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference were all 501c3s. If the Frontiers of Freedom and the timber industry are allowed to enforce this standard of law that they're maintaining, what they're saying is essentially, right, in fact, effectively, that Martin Luther King should have had his tax status stripped. We just don't think that's the case. We think there's a long American tradition of public protest and that it should be protected at all costs.
George Landreth, your response?
Well, it's amusing rhetoric, but the fact is the NAACP and both and the Sierra Club, they have 501c4 designations, which let them engage in things other than educational activity, and all they do is they can't collect tax-exempt donations. So that's a bit of a ruse to try to wrap themselves in somehow the civil rights movement. I mean, the fact is there's all sorts of groups that are out there today with whom, quite frankly, some of them we don't agree with, and we haven't gone after them. And the reason is because they're abiding by the law, and they have a right to disagree with us as we with them, but they don't have a right to disagree and at the same time go after an advantageous tax status and then flout the law. And that's all we're concerned with. If we were just trying to silence the messenger, as he said, then we'd go after all the groups we disagree with, and we don't. We're a strong believer, and I personally am a strong believer in the First Amendment. I think it's important. It's key to the political debate. It's the idea that you have a marketplace of ideas, and you let the best ideas rise to the top.
You've called RAN an eco-terrorist organization. What do you mean by that?
Well, what we mean by that is it's an organization that rather than using traditional educational means to try to get its viewpoint out to the public, its organizers, its officers, its supporters are involved in all sorts of unlawful acts that are designed instead of educate, to try to force people to do things or coerce them to do things or to scare them into doing things. And it strikes me that that's counterproductive. We believe that education is important, but all of those things fall well outside the purview of education.
Well, Chris Hatch of the Rainforest Action Network, what about that point that that this group, the Frontiers of Freedom Institute that George Landreth heads, isn't targeting all environmental groups, only yours?
Well, for one thing, they've already announced that they intend to take this fight to other environmental groups if they're successful. But I think that, I think he's just put his foot in it right here. I mean, it's really a disingenuous argument. The NAACP and Sierra Club and others that he's referring to do have 501c4s as distinct from 501c3s. They tend to have both kinds of tax status. That's for reasons of political lobbying. The IRS is very clear on this point. This is a legal point that's been clarified over many decades, and everyone involved in this case fully knows about it. That's not the point here. The point that Frontiers is making is that any organization who conducts any illegal activities should be allowed to be a charity, and that is exactly the point of Martin Luther King Jr.'s church. Most churches in this country, for instance, are 501c3s. So any pastor that goes down to Vieque or engages in a sit-in during the civil rights movement, this is exactly the standard that would strip them of their tax status as well.
Actually, that's not really our position. It's not just illegal acts. It's the question of the education and what's educational and not. And the IRS has some standards for what is educational and what is not. And most of the things that RAN is doing fall well outside of that definition. And some of them happen to be illegal, but that's not the point. The point is that they're not educational in their nature as defined by the IRS. It seems to me the real issue here is that RAN can do whatever it wants to do. We don't, they're responsible to the law whatever they do. So the real question to us is are they entitled to collect tax-exempt dollars in order to fund this? And
George Landreth,
could
you give me some examples of what you find the Rainforest Action Network does that's outside of what a 501c3, a nonprofit group, should do?
Sure. An example is that they, just as an example here, there was in October of 96, they coordinated protests in five different cities that resulted in six different arrests. And they, involved in, trespassing and so forth and these sorts of activities. Those aren't educational in nature. The other thing that, for example, just to give you an example, their co-founder, a fellow named Mike Rozelle, made this statement, and I think this kind of gives an example of what their orientation is. I'll have to make a few deletions, but nonetheless, it says, F that crap that you read in Wild Earth or in Confessions of an Eco-Warrior, monkey wrenching is more than just sabotage. And you're G.D. right. It's revolutionary. This is jihad, pal. Everything, every assumption, every institution needs to be challenged. Now, go and get them suckers. Fill them full of steel. That's not the sort of mission statement of an educational institution.
Chris Hatch of Rainforest Action Network.
Yeah, I mean, my initial response is really, this really does make me angry. I think we're getting caught in, to call us eco-terrorists is really beyond the pale. We're absolutely a nonviolent organization. We don't condone or support any kind of property destruction or violent activities. And for, these friends of Dick Cheney's backed by the oil and timber industries to come at us calling us eco-terrorists, when you look at the litany of crimes conducted by those industries, is really just outrageous. And for them to then try to turn the tables again and say that anyone who was involved in a sit-in at a lunch counter in a civil rights movement the church should lose its tax status, I think it's just an outrage.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll also be joined by a senior attorney at the First Amendment Project in San Francisco. We're speaking with Chris Hatch, executive director of the Rainforest Action Network, based in the Bay Area, and George Landreth, executive director of the Frontiers of Freedom Institute. You're listening to Democracy Now! After that discussion, we will be hearing from investigative journalist Seymour Hersh on what he's found about Mobile's activities in Russia and Kazakhstan. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we discuss the issue of the Frontiers of Freedom Institute targeting the Rainforest Action Network and pushing for that group's nonprofit status to be revoked, we're joined by the executive director of the Frontiers of Freedom Institute, George Landreth, the executive director of Rainforest Action Network, Chris Hatch, and David Green, senior attorney at the First Amendment Project in San Francisco. Looking at the complaint that the Frontiers of Freedom Institute has written to Commissioner Charles Rosati of the Internal Revenue Service, it goes through RAND's activities. It says, one, looking at what RAND did against Mitsubishi, conducting a five-year campaign against Mitsubishi. In a letter to supporters declaring victory, RAND took credit for pressuring the company through an international boycott and other actions to implement specific changes in its business practices and to contribute money to an environmental fund. In the letter, RAND boasts this agreement also proves civil disobedience gets results. Another example that the Frontiers of Freedom Institute gives in pushing for the tax-exempt status to be taken away from RAND is the campaign against Home Depot, the target of RAND-sponsored civil disobedience and other actions from 97 to 99. The activity was intended to pressure the company to change the suppliers of wood it used in its products. Another example it gives is the Boise Cascade Corporation. RAND's ongoing campaign against Boise Cascade also is intended to force a change in suppliers used by a target company. RAND has vowed that it will drive Boise Cascade out of old-growth logging or business. It cites the RAND campaign against Occidental Petroleum, saying RAND's pressure campaign against Occidental Petroleum was intended to force the company to abandon certain oil development projects to which RAND objected. As part of this effort, the organization also targeted Al Gore while he campaigned for president because Gore's family held stock in the company. It cites the World Trade Organization protests, saying RAND played a leading role in organizing the mass protests and civil disobedience that disrupted the World Trade Organization meetings in Seattle. And then it goes on from there, saying activists from RAND and Greenpeace scaled the Bank of America Tower in San Francisco and hung a huge banner reading, Pac Bell destroys BC's rainforests, and cites a number of other examples. David Green, can you talk about this challenge to the nonprofit status of Rainforest Action Network? Is it typical?
Well, it's there's one thing that's very typical about it. Challenges to First Amendment activity, whether it be written advocacy, protest work, oral advocacy, artistic expression, very typically happen in a way where someone who's challenging the person's rights will say something, I completely respect the First Amendment rights of this organization, this person. They can do whatever they want. They just can't do it on public land, with public money, with any type of public support. That's very typical. We've seen that a lot through challenging federal funding of the arts, challenging all sorts of uses of government property, public property for marches, for protests. It's a very, very typical argument to say, I support your right to speak and do this, just don't do it in my park, just don't do it where I have to be aware of it. So that's very typical. Whether challenging it through the IRS, I'm not familiar with how often that's happened before in the past and whether it's been successful in the past or not.
Is there a gray area that Rainforest Action Network or other groups might step into?
Well, there are always gray areas. And the First Amendment is fraught with gray areas. And but one of the things that's very fundamental in First Amendment law is that when you're in the gray area, you err on preserving First Amendment rights. A very fundamental principle of the First Amendment is that there has to be clear guidelines on how to behave if you're going to restrict, and not just restrict, but if you're going to deny somebody a benefit based on their First Amendment activity. And what the First Amendment does teach us is that when you err, if there is something unclear, you err on the side of preserving the First Amendment rights, and this is to avoid what we call the chilling effect, so that people will not, for fear of losing a governmental benefit, being punished in some other way, will not unnecessarily curtail their First Amendment activity.
What would the effect be if the challenge to RAND is successful, if they were to lose their nonprofit status?
I think it would be huge, not just for groups on the left or environmental groups like RAND, but for all nonprofit organizations that engage in any type of advocacy. I have this idea that there's this line between education and advocacy is really foreign to it, my understanding of the way the entire nonprofit world works. Advocacy in terms of organizing boycotts, trying to convince people to do others to operate in a different way, organizing protests, marching in the streets, these are really time-honored and well-respected nonprofit activities. And again, the line is usually drawn, or has been drawn to this point, between the type of advocacy that a 501c3 cannot do is legislative advocacy. That would be considered something a 501c4 could do, and or electioneering for a candidate. And actually, even 501c3s are permitted to do some amount of legislative advocacy. There's not a total ban on it. So it would be huge. Again, this isn't just about what groups on the left can do, or what environmental groups can do. This is about how all nonprofit organizations operate. So,
is this approach that the Frontiers of Freedom Institute is taking similar to a SLAPP lawsuit? And can you explain what that is?
Well, a SLAPP suit, a SLAPP SLAPP is an acronym for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. And those are lawsuits that are filed not because there's a belief the lawsuit will be successful, but to but because litigation itself is so onerous and resource consuming, even if you win, that just the mere filing of the lawsuit will discourage somebody from engaging in their First Amendment activity, either their right to speak or write or protest or to petition the government as well. So that's what a slap suit is. Now, this is the difference is that this isn't a lawsuit; it's just a letter to a governmental organization. So that's it's not technically a lawsuit, but I don't know if Frontiers of Freedom actually believe that this is going to be successful. If they did, if they were doing it actually because they want the IRS to take action and not just to discourage RAND and other groups, then it's not a typical slap suit, but certainly the idea that you are seeking to, you're challenging someone's right to engage in legitimate First Amendment activity is akin to a slap suit, I guess.
David Green of the First Amendment Project in San Francisco. I wanted to turn back to George Landreth, executive director of the Frontiers of Freedom Institute, and talk about some of your funders. There have been a lot of stories about them in the news lately. For example, you're accusing RAN of illegal behavior and calling it an eco-terrorist group. But many would say that your funders also engage in illegal behavior. For example, a human rights group has filed suit against ExxonMobil, accusing the world's largest oil company of massive human rights abuses in Indonesia. The group sued on behalf of 11 villagers in Aceh who said that ExxonMobil complicitly aided in genocide, murder, torture, and sexual abuse at the hands of local security forces employed by the company. Actually, Business Week did a very interesting story on this several years ago, alleging that ExxonMobil provided equipment for the digging of mass graves that some ExxonMobil, or at the time Mobil workers, were put into in Aceh. One of your funders is ExxonMobil. Then another of your funders is R.J. Reynolds. A few years ago, the government of Canada filed a lawsuit in U.S. federal court around R.J. Reynolds, saying that R.J. Reynolds' companies defrauded the Canadian people by conspiring with known distributors and smugglers to illegally smuggle their tobacco products into Canada. And there are other cases of the kind of companies that support your group. What would you say about that?
Well, first of all, I'm not aware of any of these cases, but you mentioned cases being filed. I'd be curious to see what the results were. You can file any case you want. I think the attorney who just spoke talked about slap suits, and that's what that sounds like to me. But at any rate, ultimately, I'm not particularly concerned about a discussion of where our money is coming from, because ultimately what matters is our ideas. And if our ideas are good ideas, then that's not relevant. I mean, we're not, for example, complaining about who RAND's donors are. What we're concerned about and what we think is odd is that there are a lot of groups out there that agree with RAND on issues, but they have filed and observed the law by becoming the sort of organization that can do the things that RAND does. But RAND wants to have it both ways. They want to be able to do whatever they want in terms of advocacy, and they also want the benefits of tax-deductible contributions. And it just strikes me there's a ton of organizations out there that have done it right and don't try to get it both ways, and that's the issue here. And RAND can spend all the time they want trying to frame it as a First Amendment issue, and that's just bunk, because they could continue doing what they're doing now, and that's fine. But they have to abide by the law. I mean,
well, let me ask Chris Hatch.
Timothy McVeigh had claimed that what he was doing was educational. I think most people would laugh at that, and I think, you know.
Are you comparing RAND to Timothy McVeigh?
No, obviously not. I'm not aware that RAND has killed 168 people. My point is education does mean something, and you can't just say that what we're doing is somehow educational because we're getting our point across. Organizing a protest in Seattle where there's violence and destruction isn't educational, and at least not by any normal standards, and that's my point.
Chris Hatch, can you respond to that, Executive Director of the Rainforest Action Network?
Well, I mean, I'm
I'm insulted to be compared to Timothy McVeigh. I mean, how disingenuous to bring it up and then say that I'm not, you know, we're not comparing you to them. I mean, this is just, it's dirty tricks. You know, it's a smear campaign. It's backed by big oil and big timber. And we're taking it really quite seriously because big oil and big timber, particularly Boise Cascade, who's orchestrating this campaign, has brought in a conservative lobby group that's very tight with Vice President Dick Cheney and have lots of backing from large industry, deep industry pockets. And this may signal a change in tone in Washington that's going to have a really chilling effect on progressive advocacy.
Can you talk about whether you believe who funds the Frontiers of Freedom Institute is a relevant issue?
Well, I think it's absolutely a relevant issue. I mean, the main principle, really, of politics is follow the money. You know, see whose interest is at stake here. And I think it's very clear in this case that the Frontiers of Freedom Institute is an industry front group who is not, the mission is not at all the integrity of nonprofit tax law. This is completely and nakedly an attack on us as an organization. It's the political equivalent of an ad hominem attack, where the issues and the public debate is going very much in favor of the environment, and so industry comes in and tries to silence us through whatever kind of backdoor dirty tricks means they can. I think that in this case it's not working very well because it's getting a lot of public coverage, and generally speaking, the actions of Frontiers of Freedom have been very unpopular.
Can you talk about the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise and Boise Cascade, both of which are going after you?
Well, Boise Cascade is orchestrating this campain. They're one of the largest logging companies.
Yeah, I'll give you 1 minute, George Landreth, in a second.
We don't get money from them. I don't understand all this linkage there, but anyhow.
You don't get money from Boise Cascade?
No. I've been here for 3 years, and we haven't gotten a dime from them in
Chris
three
Hatch.
Years.
Well, so let's go back a few weeks to George Landreth and Malcolm Wallop, the Frontiers of Freedom, standing up on Capitol Hill with the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise. Their top billing guy on that Senate briefing was Ron Arnold, who runs the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise, which is, in fact, founded by and funded by Boise Cascade and the timber and oil industries also. This is all part of a concerted smear campaign. They have attack websites up mocking the Rainforest Action website. They've held public events trying to link us to eco-terrorists. It's all part of a relatively sophisticated and really well financially backed campaign to attack us as an organization.
First of all, our top billing person was Senator Orrin Hatch, and our second billing person was Congressman Nethercutt.
Let me read off the press release.
And then
Ron Arnold,
the idea
will highlight.
The idea that is a well-orchestrated
spokesperson
on
our briefing
campaign
will highlight the role of the Rainforest Action Network.
The idea that there's a high, that somehow money, I mean, you guys have infinitely more dollars than we have, and it just, I'm amused by the kind of poor, poor, pitiful us we're being picked on by, you know, big industry. I wish all that money you're talking about was there, because that would make our job a lot easier. But the fact is, we abide by the law, and we have, I mean, I run a C3 organization. I run a C4 organization. I understand the differences between the two, and I understand the constraints between the two. And we do, in fact, have to do some things differently for one organization than the other, as the law requires. And it just seems that you all want your cake and eat it, too. And that's the frustrating part for groups like ours, is we feel like it's a good idea if the law is observed. We feel like the law ought to be observed. And we see a group out there that flouts it, does so proudly, and then tries to wrap itself in the First Amendment and complain like it's being picked on.
Chris Hatch, has this challenge to your nonprofit status, has it affected the activities of the Rainforest Action Network?
Well, it sure it has. I mean, the whole point of the strategy, I mean, they don't think they can win this. It's been 100 years these protest activities have been going on. The IRS has never closed anyone down. Their point is to try and use their financial pockets to drain ours. And every moment we spend fighting lawsuits or talking on the radio about this case as opposed to talking about the logging that's going on in national forests and around the world is actually a victory for the other side. So it is having an effect. We do think that we can turn it around, and in the end, this will actually be helpful in terms of protecting forests, but certainly it's a big concern.
The issue of donors, have your donors been gone after?
Yeah, Boise Cascade and the Center for Defense of Free Enterprise have been approaching our donors as well in a sort of low-level harassment campaign. I don't really see that it's going to go anywhere. Let me just one point on donors, because I know we're short on time. But the average CEO that's financing Frontiers of Freedom or Center for Defense of Free Enterprise or these other outfits has more take-home pay in terms of salary and stock options than our entire annual organizational budget. And so I really do feel like the argument around financing here by George Landros is really disingenuous.
Well, I'd like to get your websites and information on all of your groups that people can go to the websites and do further research on this. George Landros, Executive Director of the Frontiers of Freedom Institute based in Fairfax, Virginia, where can people go to get more information?
We can be found at www.ff.org.
Chris Hatch, Executive Director of the Rainforest Action Network.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's ran.org.
And David Green with the First Amendment Project.
We are www.thefirstamendment.org.
Well, we'll certainly continue to follow this case. And I want to thank you all for being with us. When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by investigative reporter Seymour Hirsch, cover story of this week's New Yorker magazine about Mobile's activities in Kazakhstan and Russia. What did Mobile do to get at one of the world's richest crude fields? Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. This week, Fortune magazine will release its list of the 500 largest corporations in the world. Replacing General Motors at the top of the list is ExxonMobil, which merged in 1999 to form the largest oil corporation since the breakup of the Standard Oil monopoly at the turn of the century. Exxon's profits in the year 2000 were a staggering $17.7 billion, a 124% increase over the year before the merger. ExxonMobil operations now span the entire globe. This weekend, ExxonMobil announced it'll spend $1.7 billion on three oil and gas projects in Malaysia, where it's the largest oil producer. In Indonesia, where ExxonMobil is the largest producer of oil and natural gas, the company says it plans to resume production soon in Aceh, where the Indonesian military has killed more than 1,000 people this year in a brutal counterinsurgency a campaign focused in part on protecting the company's operations. But the real hunt is in the countries of the Caspian Sea region, including Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, where the world's largest remaining reserves of untapped oil and natural gas are located, and which has become a focal point of U.S. foreign policy. Exxon and Mobil were major players in the Caspian Sea region before their merger and became the dominant company in the region after they joined. In 1996, Mobil signed an agreement with the government of Kazakhstan for a share of the fabulously wealthy Tenzik oil field. But an internal inquiry conducted by the Mobil Corporation before its merger with Exxon in 1999 found the company paid more than $1 billion to foreign companies in connection with arrangements in Russia and Kazakhstan that had no apparent business purpose. The payments, however, may have been related to a plan for Kazakhstan to swap oil with Iran, with Mobil helping to foot the bill in violation of U.S. sanctions against doing business in Iran. It's a complicated story involving former Russian Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin, business intermediaries from half a dozen countries, and the world's largest oil company. It's a story that reveals a lot about how the modern oil industry works and the lengths to which oil companies will go to gain a stake in countries where corruption and backroom deals grease the skids. We're joined now by Seymour Hersh, one of the nation's leading investigative journalists. Seymour Hersh won the Pulitzer Prize for exposing the My Lai massacre during the Vietnam War. He's author of The Price of Power, a biography of Henry Kissinger, and The Dark Side of Camelot, an expose of the Kennedy administration. Now, the cover story of this week's New Yorker magazine called Big Oil in Bad Places. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Seymour Hersh. Hi. Can you talk about how you came across this story?
Well, I mean, in a sentence, it's tough because basically I was following a little bit the politics, the internal politics in Kazakhstan. There was Nazarbayev, the president of Kazakhstan, is one of the great ruffians of our time, as is everybody in the former Soviet Union. Most of those countries are very corrupt. And, of course, it's one of the scandals of our foreign policy is that we the United States, do nothing really very much about the corruption except acquiesce. Essentially because there's a lot of oil and other natural materials there. So I was just following that issue, and there was an opposition guy named Kasha Geldin. All these names are, when I used to work at the New York Times, Bill Sapphire would call me go, my eyes glaze over. And one of the problems about writing about all of this area, as you said, it's complicated, it's dense, involves a lot of foreign names that people don't really aren't very familiar with, and also countries, certainly the Caspian countries, not much familiarity here in the United States with those countries. And so you're sort of dealing on the dark side of the moon, and that's why it's very tough for journalists to get their teeth into these stories, because it's just very hard. Anyway, I just was following the politics, and last summer, there were some stories about an American named James Giffen, who was a fixer in Kazakhstan. He had gone over, been active in trying to get the Soviets involved in trade in the 80s, sort of a minor league arm and hammer. And then when Russia collapsed, he ended up in Kazakhstan as sort of the aide-de-camp to the president, Nazarbayev. And Giffen was named in newspaper stories as being the subject of intense scrutiny by the U.S. Justice Department for money laundering, et cetera, bribery. And that sort of triggered me into what the hell's going on there.
So you have these players. Could you expand more on them and how they're connected to countries and to corporations? I mean, particularly Mobil, what Mobil's connections are to James Giffen and to, the prime minister of Kazakhstan.
Well, Giffen, by anybody's standard, is a middleman. Giffen's job is to Giffen moved into a position of great power inside Kazakhstan, because he was advising Nazarbayev on who to deal with. And, of course, the country was, you know, rich in oil. You mentioned the Tengiz field is one of the largest, perhaps. We just don't know. There could be as much as 100 billion barrels lying under the, you know, under the water and under the land in Kazakhstan and the Caspian, too. It's just huge. And so Giffen's the guy you need to get to if you want to do business in Kazakhstan, particularly if you want to do oil business, which means that you're dealing in the area of total corruption in the sense of violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. The United States is one of the leading countries in terms of legislation on the books. After this, a lot of scandals stemming from the Nixon administration, or Watergate, what you will, the Lockheed payoff scandals in the 1970s, Congress passed legislation that simply said United States corporations cannot pay bribes. Period. They can't use brokers. They can't use middlemen who do nothing but front for people collecting bribery. And that seems to be the consensus of what Giffen's being looked at. He's certainly under investigation by two grand juries, one in Washington and one in New York, the Southern District of New York.
And so companies went in there. Mobile's big function was to find a way into Tengiz, and they dealt with Giffen. Lou Noto, the president of Mobile, was involved, and there was a series of meetings in early late 95 and 96 in which Mobile ended up paying $1 billion plus for access, one quarter of the Tengiz field. And as I write about it, that purchase was very problematical for a lot of reasons. One, it's not clear that all of the $1 billion ended up in the treasury. I quote officials as saying the 300 or 350 million ended up, and we're talking about huge, staggering amounts of money. $350 million, my God! But $600 or $700 million, apparently by late '97, early '98, had not been received by the Treasury of Kazakhstan, which leads, you know, we can only speculate. Secondly, Mobil also got involved in a series of other very complicated negotiations involving Chernomyrdin, the Russian head of the former prime minister who was head of Gazprom, the huge monopoly for gas and oil in Russia.
Which has now taken over the last independent media outlet there, Media Most.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about media in Russia. It turns out every oligarch, and Chernomyrdin was certainly by any definition an oligarch, every oligarch in Russia, part of their system is a radio station or a TV network or some public media connection. And the only other major country where you really have this now, Italy sort of now, but before that would be America, where major corporations, you know, you're not a great corporation, ABC, Disney, and the GE, unless you own a network or some media. So we have this wonderful parallelism. It's hard for Americans to accept it, but it is true that in a funny way, the way our media is controlled by conglomerates is similar to the way the Russian oligarchs control their media. It's not very attractive. Anyway, the point is that in this article, there's a series of connections that were made that I described in great detail and lead us to say that I think as many as six or seven law firms at various times wrote what only can be described as very threatening letters to The New Yorker. And by the way, to The New Yorker's credit, this story took months and months and a lot of legal work. And believe me, when I first filed it, it was written in the equivalent of Serbo-Croatian. It was so dense. And to even as dense as it is, a lot of work went into trying to make it more readable for the average reader, so you can get some sense of how complicated it is. In any case, there was one deal Mobile had to get into involved pre-financing a oil and gas deal and something called condensate that went into Russia that Mobile took anywhere from $76 million to $100 million plus baht, and that money clearly ended up in Chernomyrdin's hands. They had to pay off Chernomyrdin to get access to the oil field. And the other part of the deal was to get oil out. You had to build a pipeline. That's one reason Chernomyrdin controlled the pipelines, and you had to take care of him. But and there was a pipeline that got going in 96, 97 that is working now. But to get the oil out immediately, various officials, a senior official of Mobil, conspired, so I write, with Giffen, and another American to facilitate what was envisioned to be a 10-year, $6 billion-plus swap of oil with Iran.
Explain what you mean by swap.
Well, okay, it's real simple, but it's very hard for people to understand. Oil is moved to get oil. Kazakhstan's landlocked. It's got access to the Caspian, but that doesn't take you very far. To get its oil out, it needs a pipeline. The problem with the pipeline by 95, 96 is all of the pipelines in Kazakhstan went through Russia because, of course, for many years it was a Russian colony, really, part of the Russian Soviet Union. And the Russians are notorious. Everything you send up into, once the communism fell and Russia got control of the pipelines, and they simply bled these independent countries dry. They would tax the pipes, charge an enormous amount to move oil, siphon off oil. It was just hopeless to try and deal with Russia. So the way to get oil out would be to try and swap it. In other words, you would ship oil somewhere to a country very close that would then in return give you oil somewhere else to pick up in a warm water port, for example. In the case of the swap in question, Kazakhstan, the oil fields are only a few hundred miles north of Tehran in Iran. Tehran's a tremendous user of it's a huge city. And most of the oil in Iran, the oil fields are about 500 miles south, 400 to 500 miles south of Tehran. So if the Iranian government wanted to use their own oil, they would have to collect it in the south of Iran, ship it by pipeline north 400 or 500 miles. And every mile you ship oil is expensive, costs a fortune. And so the way you save money and make money is you limit the amount of shipping. So the idea was to have the Kazakhstan oil from Tengiz be sent down by boat 200 miles to Tehran. Tehran would use that oil locally and wouldn't have to rely on oil from the south. And in return for the oil they've got from Kazakhstan, the Kazakhstan oil company would be permitted to pick up oil, crude oil, at the southern port, 500 miles to the south, where you could ship it easily to the Far East or into Europe.
And what is the legality of this, according to U.S. law? And
oh, well, it's illegal to trade, to do any business, oil business, with Iran. The sanctions were put into effect after they took our hostages in 1980, that amazing scandal, if you remember that issue, when they seized the American embassy. There were sanctions. They were toughened by Clinton at various times, particularly in 95. So right after Clinton toughened the sanctions, made it almost impossible to get any significant amount of oil swapped, these guys constructed a deal. Of course, nobody would know Mobil was involved. The understanding was it would all be presented and all the papers would show it as being strictly Kazakh oil. But, of course, the story I'm writing about says something else. And there is a grand jury investigating this in Washington, D.C., that's been looking into a swap for more than a year. It's a very tough call because, to be honest, you're going after the biggest oil company in the world. Huge money to spend on lawyers, and the federal government's pretty much outgunned, and yet they're doing this investigation because they have a lot of very strong empirical evidence that indeed certain high-level people in Mobil countenance the swap, and the question for the federal government is, how up did this go? And again, this is in the years immediately before Mobil merged with Exxon, and the idea of getting Tengiz in terms of Mobil was essential because with a field like Tengiz, Mobil would be much more valuable as a merger partner.
And Patton Boggs, the most powerful corporate law firm in Washington, D.C., its role in this?
Well, Patton Boggs, what happened is the plan to do the big swap involved using middlemen in Iran and a Jordanian in London, both of whom were promised the equivalent of about $40 million in fees if they could help facilitate the swap. It wasn't illegal for these. They're not Americans. They did so, and when things got in place, all of a sudden the Americans, including the senior Mobil executive, a guy named Brian Williams, in charge of all overseas trading by Mobil, a longtime 20-year employee, a former lawyer, very close to Lunoto, all of these men suddenly began to cut back on the money they promised their two fellow
Only have a minute to go. So.
Well, basically they cut back on the middlemen. And the middlemen, one of them complained, filed a court case. Though the case was sealed, it was made known to the Mobil officials. They began an internal investigation. They hired Patton Boggs. Patton Boggs did a huge investigation internally, much of which I write about. I must tell you, it's all attorney-client stuff. I've probably never had such good access. In the end, nothing was done. Patton Boggs was released. Mobil reported none of these allegations to anybody, including the SEC. It clearly had an obligation to do so. At least most outsiders would think so. The stockholders weren't told. I don't know what Exxon knew. I don't know how much due diligence was done, but everything was covered over until this story.
Seymour Hersh, you say you never had such good access. How about coverage of your story?
Oh, horrible, of course. A major oil company. What else is new?
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. And the last question, totally out of left field, but based on your book about Henry Kissinger, do you think the authorities are going to ever be able to move in on him?
Oh, no. I mean, are they able to? Of course. Are they theoretically able to? Is there a case? Will they? Are you kidding? Why should they?
Seymour Hersh has been our guest. His piece is Big Oil in Bad Places, What Did Mobil Do to Get at One of the World's Richest Crude Fields? Talking about Kazakhstan and Russia. It's the cover story of The New Yorker this week. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan, our engineer. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of You, Our Listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!